Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Sam Kropp and Dylan Thompson. Sam Kropp is an environmental and social justice activist and high school teacher currently based in Eugene, Oregon. Originally from Florida, Sam has been an organizer in direct action campaigns for farm worker rights, food justice and food sovereignty, forest defense, and fossil fuel resistance, and has been a public speaker at a variety of events on environmental issues and social justice activism. Sam's also the founder of Warrior Sisters, a women's self-defense nonprofit, and like many feminists before her, recognizes that the ongoing abuse of the planet and the epidemic of violence against women share the same root in a way of life that is fundamentally unsustainable. Dylan Thompson is co-founder and secretary of the Fertile Ground Institute, a nonprofit working to build leadership and effective strategy for social and environmental justice movements. For the past 6 years, Dylan's work with Fertile Ground has included providing trainings, lecturing, hosting interdisciplinary conferences, and organizing nonviolent direct actions up and down the west coast of the U.S. and Canada. His work is motivated by a love of life and a deep rage for the cold, dispassionate killing of non-human communities perpetrated by the daily activities of the industrial economy. So for both of you, first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Derek.
So the first question is, what are coal trains and what's wrong with them?
Well, the way I like to think about coal trains, and it's really the only effective way to think about coal trains, is that they are a link between coal mining and coal combustion. So, as for the United States, coal is being mined primarily out of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, and then that coal is shipped by rail to various terminals on the west coast of both the United States and Canada, and then shipped over to China. And last I checked, there was one new coal-fired power plant being built every week in China. So this appetite for coal is not something that's small, and it's continuing to grow. So what is a coal train? It's a link between the mining and the combustion of it. And why is it bad? Well, there are tons of reasons why they're bad, and it's almost silly, the amount of reasons.
I think one thing that's important to mention too is, before we even talk about the reasons why the coal trains are bad, is, so what is, you know, what is coal as it's used as a fossil fuel? And I think that's an important piece, because we have all these different fossil fuels, but coal is kind of widely known as one of the most dirty fossil fuels that we use. Coal-fired power plants are emitting about 1.6 tons of climate-changing gases for every ton of coal burn. So that's a huge amount. And it's also the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel. So one of the things that coal trains are doing is, so like Dylan said, they're taking this coal from the fossil fuel plants, and they're bringing it to places where they're going to be synthesized or exported. And there's a few things that are problematic with coal trains. One of the things that's been most studied is just the coal dust that is coming off of these coal trains. So basically, in a coal train, you have anywhere from 125 to 150 different cars on a single train. And each of those is carrying and emitting about 645 pounds of coal dust. So that's per car. So in total, that's about 80,625 pounds of coal dust just being released in a single trip. And that coal dust is, of course, going into the air, it's going into the water, it's going into the lungs of the people who live in the communities surrounding the coal trains, and that's obviously hugely problematic in itself. But another really widely studied problem with coal trains is just the diesel exhaust from the engines. So these engines are releasing diesel particulates that are basically really small particles of air pollution that are able to penetrate deep into the lungs of people. And so there have been countless studies that show the connections between those diesel particulates and asthma rates and cardiovascular problems. So there's that aspect as well.
And I lived in Bellingham, Washington for about 6 years. And during that time, the Cherry Point export terminal was in development, or at least the plans for it were. And there was a pretty large mobilization in that community against that coal terminal. And so I became very familiar with that particular communities, gripes with coal transport. And there's really no benefit to a community, that coal trains, have. And, you know, in addition to what Sam just said, community members were concerned about the impact that trains would have, in the city and how it would delay morning commutes, evening commutes. It would delay emergency service. It would delay their response times. And keep in mind that if the Cherry Point terminal is built, they were estimating that, there would be about 30 miles of coal trains going through Bellingham daily. Which would also constrain passenger rail and other freight traffic. So local business owners were just up in arms about it. Especially if they had businesses near the tracks, if they had businesses near the marine area where that coal was being shipped to, you know, taxpayers are going to be paying for the new infrastructure. People were up in arms about property values decreasing. And then that's the terrestrial stuff. And then the marine, once you get the coal out to the terminal, and this is in the Puget Sound, which is littered with islands and narrow straits, which is already, home to a lot of oil tankers. And so now you're going to have these coal ships sharing that space with these oil tankers. So those were just some of the issues. And then that's not even to get into the issue of ecology. A lot of these new rail loops that they would be building would be built on, wetlands and uplands. And, keep in mind, this is specifically in reference to Whatcom County where the Cherry Point terminal was going to be built. There's impacts on marine life. There is the Cherry Point Aquatic Preserve, which is in close proximity to where that coal would have been stored in open storage facilities in a high wind area. So you can only imagine that there would be coal dust, getting into the water, and affecting creatures there. So that's kind of what I heard a lot when I lived in that community and was doing organizing work around this.
So I kind of think that the bottom line with coal trains is that you can't really think about them in a vacuum. You can't think of them without thinking of the sum of all of the pieces that go into coal extraction, and the burning of coal and the transportation, all of the impacts of the dust and the diesel emissions, and the dredging of the oceans where they're going to put in these terminals, and the shipment. And of course, you can't think about it without thinking about the inevitability of derailments. And this is something that the industry doesn't quite like to talk about, but we know, and it's just fact that derailments happen, and they happen quite frequently. In fact, there was actually just one last week in Eugene, Oregon. Thankfully, it was just grain that was spilled, but train derailments are a very, very common thing. And last I checked, just this year, we've had over 15 derailments of trains in the United States, and it's only the 1st of October. So this is something that we have to consider. And when a train derails, especially if it's carrying coal, it becomes a massive environmental catastrophe for the ecosystems and the human communities that it derails in.
So you mentioned a number a while ago about 30 miles of coal trains. Was that per day, you said?
Correct, yeah.
And what is the scale? That's just for one terminal, right? But what do you know what the scale is of transporting coal? I mean, how many cars or trains or miles of coal is transported to the West Coast daily, weekly, any number?
So if we're just talking about the West Coast, we're mostly looking at coal coming from the Powder River Basin, which is typically about a 400-mile journey. So on that 400-mile journey, the coal is kind of fingering out. It starts at one major coal line coming out of the Powder River Basin, and when it gets to the Pacific Northwest, it fingers out to a bunch of different terminals that are up and down the coast, including in British Columbia. A lot of those terminals are slated for expansion, and a lot of those proposals have been halted thanks to the work of activists. But essentially, we're looking at 400-mile journey, and about 125 to 150 coal-carrying cars per each coal train. And each of those trains is anywhere from a mile to a mile and a half long. So again, with that number, with the amount of coal dust particulates, that's about 80,000 pounds of coal dust released into the air. And that's just per one train on that one journey.
And how many trains do we know? How many trains per day or week or any amount?
No. In Bellingham, I know with the proposed gateway or the Pacific Gateway Terminal there, I think there was going to be something like 8 coal trains per day. And that was going to be up from maybe 1 per day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it really just depends based on the terminal. A lot of the terminals were slated for different kinds of expansion. In places like Canada, in the British Columbia export terminals, they're seeing upwards of 15 coal trains a day because that's the largest export terminal on our coast. But in places like Bellingham, currently it's about one or a few coal trains a day, but it's different for each of the proposed terminals.
And I don't know the most recent numbers, but I know that I see articles quite often about some climate change activists will get all excited because the United States is burning less coal than it used to. And I saw one just yesterday that they were really crowing that coal is dead in the United States because there is less electricity generated by coal in the U.S. than in previous years. But what that ignores is that actual coal extraction is going up because of what you said about exports to China and some other countries. So that seems to be disingenuous to argue that coal is actually dead when there is this high level of transport of exportation going on.
Yeah, it is really disingenuous. I think especially when we consider the fact that we all share an earth and we all share an atmosphere. So, you know, if we're not burning as much coal within the borders of the United States, but places in Asia are burning far more coal than they ever have before, it kind of, you know, undoes any good that the United States is doing. But it is true that, so United States is the fourth largest coal exporter in the world. And some of the more recent predictions, they are showing that the United States, so we're consuming less coal within our borders, but we're exporting far more coal to Asian countries because they're, you know, becoming more industrialized and demanding more coal. So yeah, definitely. And since the Powder River Basin really became, really hit its peak, the amount of coal that we're producing and exporting has gone higher than ever in the United States. So I think that is a really good point.
So I want to talk in a little while about an action that took place near Bellingham. But before we go there, I want to tell you a quick story and get as long a response as you want to this story. My niece's husband is from China, and my niece and her family were visiting, and we... please excuse me, we went to Walmart, and standing in the, it's a little small town, and Walmart's destroyed all the other stores, so just give me a break, okay? anyway, so we're standing in the parking lot, and my niece's husband, whose politics don't really match mine at all, or yours, presumably, he said, and he's maybe 35, and he said, in my lifetime, the skies in China have gone from blue to gray to brown to black. And they have done that so that Americans can have cheap plastic goods. Hmm. And then he said, and I understand that economies need to grow, which is a place I would disagree with him. I understand that economies need to grow, but the price has been so high. And given that China is putting in, what you said, one new coal factory every week? Was that it?
Yes.
Yeah. It seems that his comment seems relevant to our conversation. So do you want to go anywhere with that, either of you?
Yeah, it seems very relevant. You know, it just makes me think of, even in the mainstream, you know, climate world, the predictions about what changes will need to happen in the industrial economy are becoming increasingly, you know, in some people's eyes, extreme. There was a new report by an organization called Oil Change International, that using the statistics from the Paris Climate Summit shows that the key number of new fossil fuel projects that the world can build and still keep those promises from that summit is zero. There can be no more fossil fuel growth. And so given that, why are these large companies like, you know, Burlington Northern and Peabody Coal, continuing not only to maintain what current projects they have, but amp up their production? And so, you know, there is some kind of psychosis, some kind of cultural psychosis there, and it's difficult to put your finger on, but, you know, more and more people, like your niece's husband there, understands that there is a large cost, and it's becoming harder to hide from that cost. And so that's why, you know, when these companies propose to actually amp up their production in the face of something like the Paris Climate Summit, it's just outrageous. And then, you know, that's why we're calling for resistance.
Yeah, and I think that that brings up a really good point, that we can't talk about the problems with coal if we're not talking about the problem with our economic system. Because our economic system, as it's structured, like you said, is predicated on the necessity for growth, which, as we know, on a planet that has finite resources, continuous growth is impossible. It's structurally impossible. So that's, you know, problem number one is this idea that we're going to continue to grow our economy under the current system of growth while somehow stopping cascading climate change. And I think that, like, there's this widespread confusion that those two things can happen at the same time, that we can grow the economy and that we can also protect the environment. And it seems like even mainstream environmentalists, but even more radical environmentalists, aren't yet willing to acknowledge that the growth of our economy and the ecological defense actually exist on an inverse relationship to each other. And as hard and frustrating as that is, it's the reality. Our GDP is based on extractive industry. When our GDP goes up, we become richer, our economy grows. But in order to do that, we have to be continuing to extract the things that we're extracting. And those are the exact same industries that are contributing to climate change. So it is not, you know, it is not incorrect to say that if we actually want to be serious about stopping climate change and environmental collapse, then we actually have to be willing to reconsider or redefine what it means to have a healthy economy.
So, I mean, as things stand, I mean, that's what GNP is. I mean, production is the conversion of the living to the dead, and GNP is a measure of how quickly you're doing that. Years and years ago, I was doing a talk with Ward Churchill, and before we went out to talk, we were sitting backstage, and I said, you know, it's extraordinary to me that the Germans kept such meticulous records of their atrocities in the Holocaust. I mean, that's just crazy, as well as being, you know, atrocity. The Holocaust themselves were just terrible, but they kept these meticulous records of how many, you know, gold teeth they pulled out and stuff. That's nuts. And he just looked at me and he said, Derek, what do you think GNP is? And mm-hmm. That really struck me.
Yeah. We don't really think about it that way because we don't think about the rest of the non-human world as life, as living, and as, you know, we don't consider it a genocide because we don't consider it worthy of paying attention to. But if we do consider it that way, if we consider the living world in the way that most healthy, sustainable cultures historically have considered it, as, first of all, integral to who we are as a people, but also valid and inherently good or inherently legitimate in itself, then, yeah, then I think that that's a really, really good analogy, a suitable analogy.
So recently, within the last couple months, there was an action protesting the trains. Can you tell me about the action?
Sure. So this was also in Bellingham. And I'm going to give you a little bit of background actually from my time in Bellingham, with my work with Fertile Ground Institute. While we were there, we decided to focus on a related issue. It wasn't about coal, but it was about oil coming from the Alberta tar sands, and that unrefined crude, actually the bitumen, that needed further refining was being shipped into Bellingham into one of the refineries there, and the community didn't know about that, and a lot of them didn't even know what the tar sands is, what that project is, and how horrible it is. So we decided to hold a public event in which we educated the community and then developed a plan to try to get, you know, to have the city ban tar sands crude from being shipped into the city. And so we went about this in, you know, the prescribed ways. We went to the city council. We lobbied them. We told them that, you know, Bellingham has already, you know, said it's committed to being a quote unquote green city. And so this just goes totally against the values and on and on. And what we learned from that experience was that the rights of commerce, the perceived rights of industrial commerce trumps the rights of community. Because what the city council told us when we asked them to ban, was that our hands are tied. This is commerce issue and our rights, we cannot ban this because we do not have the authority to do so. And so to make a longer story short, that prompted us to then move on to the next stage in our resistance, which was to organize with the community. And we were peripherally involved in some of these actions. But there were many community members who rallied around the issue of coal and the tar sands. There were some blockades and many protests, but to fast forward to what happened recently, there was an action on the 27th of August, in which a coal train that was carrying more than 22 million pounds of coal, was blocked for about 12 hours. So there was a tripod hoisted up on the railroad tracks, just right by the bay. And, there's this one activist hanging from this tripod. And it stopped a coal train. And then what's notable about this action is that, that first blockade was not the only action, against that particular train. So the tripod was erected around 4 p.m. and it wasn't dismantled until about 11:45 p.m., which was almost 8 hours. And then when that tripod was dismantled, two more activists locked themselves to the train itself, which delayed it for another 3 hours, 3.5 hours. So all in all, we were looking at about 11 to 12 hour delay. And, you know, I said it's notable because I was also involved in some of the Break Free actions, and the Break Free actions were organized by 350.org, and there are actions all over the country protesting fossil fuel extraction. And unfortunately, the Break Free stuff, you know, it was so public, and they had to be in order to organize as many people as they did. But because it was so public, the institutions and the industries who they were targeting knew all about the plans. And so in the case of Anacortes, Washington, where they were blocking a train carrying oil to a refinery, the companies knew everything. And so therefore they shipped out extra oil beforehand and then had no trains running on the day or days of the protest. So there were about 50 people arrested, hundreds of people were there, and it was a great show of force, I guess. But all in all, I don't know what the real material effect was. And so this action in Bellingham in August, I think was a little bit more strategic. Or at least they had strategy in mind. You know, we're actually going to be mobile and flexible based on circumstances. So I guess that's the gist of what happened there. You want to add anything?
Yeah. And what I think is important too, just to reiterate what Dylan, the reason why Dylan was giving that background about the community efforts is that what we're seeing now within the past few years especially, but within the past decade really, is an increased movement of environmentalists towards this kind of direct action. And it's because the other efforts that have been tried aren't working. And that's really as simple as it gets, is that activists, environmental activists, have really tried every single avenue for keeping these dirty coal trains out of their communities. They've tried engaging with the civic process. They've tried speaking to city council members, creating petitions. They've tried putting forward community ordinances to ban coal trains from coming true. They've tried doing protests and letter writing campaigns and even electing people into local positions of government. And what we've seen is that these efforts just are not working. And the coal export is getting more and more, like you mentioned earlier. And so communities are feeling, I think, jaded by the political process and frustrated by the lack of its effectiveness, and so are taking toward direct action to actually do something about these coal trains, to actually get in the way of the trains. And like Dylan said, I think, the action that we're talking about, that we're spokespeople for, the action in Bellingham, that was one of the more effective, if not the most effective, action that we've seen recently, because A, the length of time that the train was actually delayed. So you had a real coal train, an open-faced coal train with hundreds of coal cars coming, and literally crossing over, Chuckanut Bay. And so you had a literal stopping of a train that was headed north for export in its tracks. And it actually was stopped for almost 12 hours, which is pretty unprecedented in terms of train blockades, in terms of any blockades. That's a huge amount of time. And also just the arrest of only 3 individuals, which is also, kind of unheard of. Usually a lot more people are facing jail time and having to go through the legal process, but really 3 individuals were arrested and released the same night, and they're looking to use the necessity defense, which we can talk about a little bit more. So it indicates a move towards more effective and targeted and strategic actions to actually stop these trains from coming through communities.
So why, I mean, you've answered this question on the large scale. I'm wondering about this on the particular people involved. Why did the people, I'm thinking like the, specifically the people who locked down and the person who attached to the tripod, why did they choose to do this?
Well, if you look up the action, you might find some of the pictures from the media, and the activist who decided to bravely hang from the tripod in front of the train was holding a sign that said "Fight for what you love," and on the sign there was also a picture of the salmon. And I know that man personally, and he, from my conversations with him, know that he has lived in that region for a very long time and is very close to the non-human communities around that area. And the impacts of the coal being transported through where he grew up and where he has lived and where he has developed a relationship with the land, you know, the impact on that and the impact on the climate as a whole, you know, has made him very mad. And he's seen what's happened when people have taken action through the prescribed channels, the legal channels, and he's seen it fail. He's seen it not be responsible to the more than human world. And so I know for him, he decided to put his body on the line as a statement and as a, you know, an escalation in tactics. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also just, like I said earlier, part of strategy. A lot of people are looking away from ideology and theory and this kind of like navel-gazing academic study of ecological issues and are looking towards what we can actually do to stop the ongoing destruction of our planet. And direct action is kind of a tried and true method for getting in the way and inconveniencing the climate or the extractive industry. the only issue, is, and that we can talk about this more, is just that, just what I said is that it is an inconvenience and it's not actually stopping this process. So direct action, the people who engaged in this direct action, I think that they were trying to send a message to others that this can work. And especially if it's done strategically like this action was, it can create a major inconvenience for the industry, a 12-hour inconvenience. But it also needs to be in coordination with other efforts, using other tactics to stop the transport of fossil fuels.
So I'm loving what you're saying so far, and I have three questions here that if you can either answer them individually or put them all together in whatever order you want. One is, you mentioned the necessity defense, and I'm just going to drop that in case you want to put that into this particular discussion. The next is, you've mentioned strategy, and what would be the larger strategy here? And that brings the third question, which is, how do we move? I mean, I think it's wonderful that everybody did this. And how do we move from inconveniencing them to seriously inconveniencing them, to making them really uncomfortable, to hurting them, to stopping them?
Mm-hmm.
So if those three things I'm throwing into a pot and see if you can make a stew out of them.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll start. That really is the question. But I think in order for that lineage that you just sort of described, Derek, from going from inconveniencing them to stopping them, in order to have a sound strategy, that has to be your goal. And you have to sit down with yourself and with the people who you are going to be working with and have that as your goal. Is your goal actually to stop them? Is it to feel good about yourself, to feel like you're doing something, or is it actually to stop them? So I think that is the number one thing that we have to do before we talk about strategy is be clear on that goal. And so, I've already had some experience with the beginnings of what I would say should be the strategy of the environmental movement. You know, we've had a modern environmental movement for over half a century now, and we've tried all the ways that those in power would have us try to be responsible to the more than human world, and they're not working. The planet is being murdered. So we're now on to phase two, or whatever phase you want to call it, which is, we can't get the bureaucratic system to make the change needed. Therefore, we have to make the change needed. And that entails putting the pressure on the companies that are, doing the mining, doing the extraction, doing the transportation, doing the burning. And there are many, many different ways to do that. I've been reading Gene Sharp lately for the first time, kind of delving into his works. And he's written God knows how many books on waging nonviolent struggle. And we need to start thinking about that as those of us who are above ground activists, and how can we really put the pressure on the points at which there needs to be pressure put? And I think the necessity defense is one way in which, that we can maybe have a little bit of hope as far as making this challenge. And Sam was going to talk about that.
Yeah. So I think just to give some background on the necessity defense, this is one way that we're looking at strategy and the interweaving of different kinds of tactics to get at the goals that we want. And so this is one thing that the environmental movement is looking at, is the interweaving of some legal tactics and direct action tactics in a really exciting way. The necessity defense isn't new. It's been used for a long time, but it is new in terms of climate defense. It argues that the actions of the defendant were not necessarily illegal, that they were actually, the defendant was actually acting in public interest, which the law would protect. So instead of seeking a plea agreement or an acquittal, defendants who would be trying to offer the necessity defense would be admitting what they did, their criminal conduct, but arguing that those actions were necessary in order to avoid a greater harm. So in the past, we've seen the necessity defense used successfully to defend people who've taken action against nuclear warfare, among other kinds of social justice issues, but we haven't seen it successfully used in the United States. It has been successfully used once in the UK, for climate justice specifically actions, and it's been attempted to be used several times in the United States for climate justice activists, but not successfully. So one of the more reassuring, one of the more exciting examples of that was the Delta Five, who attempted to use the climate necessity defense and were originally allowed to use it, and then the judge essentially decided that they were misusing it or not using it correctly, and so they weren't allowed to use it anymore. But the entire jury kind of came up to the defendants after the case and said, you know what, we agree. We think that what you did was right, and we think that what you did you deserve to be recognized for your brave actions. So we're seeing this general move towards environmental activists actually potentially being able to defend themselves in a court of law for what we really believe is a necessity. These are necessary actions for defending the future of our planet, for defending the future of humanity, and all of the creatures on this planet. So it is a really exciting move towards potentially being able to take these actions and have them excused in court. Another move towards strategic action, I think, is an example is the work that the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is doing, where they're working with communities to pass ordinances that would excuse direct action. So one example is in Spokane, Washington right now. CELDF is working with the community to put forward an ordinance that not only bars coal train transport in the entire community, but also excuses the actions of direct actioners, people participating in direct action, who get in the way of coal trains if coal trains continue to go through. So it legally basically sanctions direct action, which is a huge move. And then just to kind of add in another piece about strategy, I think that when we're talking about this kind of direct action and the necessity of direct action, we don't need to just be talking about actions like the one in Bellingham where 12 hours of delay occurs and then business continues as usual. I think what we need to be looking at is what works and what's most effective. And if we look at history and historical movements for change, we have to look at, you know, we have to consider all tactics. Because what we're looking at is, you know, the potential destruction of everything that we know, mass ecological decline. And so all options have to be on the table, and that includes sabotage. So for me, I do not take that option off the table. I think if that is an option that could work, then people, should use it and should consider it seriously. Just like historical movements for change have considered sabotage, this is a movement for life and death, and, that option should be on the table. And I think that option should also be considered in terms of the necessity defense as a necessary action for halting climate change.
And I wanted to add to that as well, just, you know, it might be, listeners may be confused as to, you know, our excitement about these things that are happening in the courts. And, because we were just saying how, you know, those are the prescribed methods that we've been told to use, to fight climate change and ecological destruction. Here we are getting excited about those very things we were just a few minutes ago harping on as being ineffective. But as Sam just said, we don't want to take anything off the table, number one. And number two, we don't see the necessity defense as the be-all, end-all of what's going to save the planet. Civilization has been at war with the planet since its inception. When the agricultural revolution started, it was drawdown and desertification, you know, spreading all over the planet. And every living system is currently in decline. So for us, you know, we just don't see anything apart from all out war on that system as realistic, or, you know, why would we choose a path besides that? So in waging this struggle, it's obviously a massive one. And so whenever we get these tools, whenever we find out about these new tools that are making things a little bit easier for activists to go down that path that you mentioned, Derek, of moving from inconveniencing them to shutting them down, we're going to use it, and we have to use everything we've got. And I think what this necessity defense thing is doing, and what this growing number of actions in the Northwest against coal trains and oil trains is doing, is building a culture of resistance. And from a culture of resistance could grow an actual all-out resistance against this culture, which is killing our one and only home, the planet.
So there's a couple directions. We have 6 or 7 or 8 minutes left, and there's a couple directions possibly to go in response to what you said. And one of them is the safe direction. The other one's the not safe direction. And I'm just going to mention both of them, and you can do whatever you want. And the safe direction is for us to, which is fine too, which is for us to talk. You mentioned that this is not the only action against these trains. And I just recently read of, I believe it was 3 women in Spokane. They call themselves Raging Grannies, who were...
Right. That's correct.
...were arrested. So we can talk about that, which is important to talk about too. And or we can also talk about what we would be doing if we... I mean, so many Indigenous people have said to me the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of that is transferring our loyalty away from the system and to the natural world. And one of the ways I've thought about this for decades now is if space aliens were doing to the planet what capitalism and civilization are doing to the planet, our discussions about resistance would be much different than they are. And when you talk about rail lines, I mean, the two things I think about were, you know, in the American Civil War, one of the reasons the North won is because they were able to destroy the Southern rail lines. And also in World War II, basically, the Germans lost for 2 big reasons. One is because of Russia, and the other is because of the Allied bombing campaign that destroyed their transportation infrastructure. So, having said all that, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. My first thought goes to the fact that although all of these actions and communities are protesting these trains that are a part of this sort of spider web coming out from the Powder River Basin, there's one rail line. There's a single point of exit from the Powder River coal basin. And then that rail line, once it gets farther west, is what spider webs out and goes to all of these proposed export sites. They've made it very easy in that regard to think strategically about how best to stop what they're doing.
If we keep this even in nonviolent civil disobedience, what it sounds to me like you're saying is that a number of people, once again, if we presume we're going to stick with nonviolent civil disobedience for the mm-hmm. moment, mm-hmm. then you could have a series of tripod actions that would stop the trains not only to Bellingham but to all up and down the coast. Is this sort of what you're saying?
Hypothetically, yes. And that I think is like to just tie in the Raging Grannies to this like more strategic discussion. I think groups like them and groups like all of the other organizations that we've been seeing in the past decade who've been doing these kinds of direct actions, I think what's building up is a coordinated action. The issue with some of the actions like Dylan was talking about with Break Free and like the Raging Grannies is those are energizing and fantastic and inspiring actions, but what we're missing is strategy. And I think what Dylan is talking about is the need to actually look at where is this coal coming from and how can we actually stop it. And so maybe that looks like coordinated actions, or maybe that looks like a better targeting of specific areas that would make more sense for stopping the coal trains. But yeah, I think what you were talking about though with these historical examples from the Civil War and from World War II, and then your hypothetical example of the aliens coming in, are all really true. And I think what it's pointing to is the fact that we have not yet named our enemy as a culture. It was easy during those times to name the enemy. It was the other people. It was the people who were not us. But right now, the enemy is a culture that subsumes everything that we know, that is everything that we know. It is our way of life. It's where we get our food in our experience. It's where we get our water in our experience. It's where, you know, our relationships come from, our livelihood comes from. And so to name that enemy is huge. And we haven't done that yet. And so until we name our enemy and identify it as what it is, I don't think are going to be willing to take up those sorts of tactics, even though history has proven they're necessary, and effective. We're not going to do that until we identify that this is actually a war.
And I think all we need to do is look at what's happening right now, at the Standing Rock Sioux site of the resistance against the Dakota Access. They're nonviolently protesting this very key point of infrastructure, and you can see how they're being treated. They're being attacked, with dogs and pepper spray, and, but that serves, to galvanize, that can serve to galvanize a movement. And I think as nonviolent resistors, we need to be thinking strategically about what's going to help people along in that shift from loyalty, you know, and exposing the true nature of empire in that way, I think is one way to do that.
So what do you, we have like 2 minutes left, and what do you want listeners of this to take away from this interview and from this action that took place near Bellingham, and what do you want for them to do?
Well, it's a big question. Personally, I feel like there's a serious lack of real thinking going on. And I want people to think about what kind of a world do they want? And not just, you know, hypothetically, but really, like, materially, what kind of a world do they want? And then to really look at what kind of a world we are going to have if things continue the way that they're continuing. And then I want people to take the action that is logically necessary, that is materially necessary to achieve the world that they want. Because I think a lot of us are living in this dream that the world that we want is somehow going to fall into our laps, and we're not making the connections between what's happening and what's to come and what needs to be done if we're actually going to save the planet. And I think if people actually start making those connections, then the path becomes really clear. We have to take action, and I want people to join us.
Yeah, I think Sam said it great there, and the only thing I would add is I think a lesson that I've been learning lately is a lesson of confidence in that, you know, if you see that this change or so-called change that's been going on in the mainstream environmental movement isn't enough, that tactics and strategies that have been used are not enough. You can go out and do, you know, you can be a part of this movement. There's so much work to be done. And there were things that I didn't think I could do that I have since tried and realized that I could do just fine. And as long as we help each other and really have those goals, like I was saying before, in front of us, I think, you know, we just need to keep moving forward.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Sam Kropp and Dylan Thompson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.